You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org. There's an app for that. Christians are accustomed to having some confidence in the factuality of what they believe, the actual historic truth claims that Christianity is built upon, that Christians believe actually occurred in real time, in real space. But I wonder how thick that confidence really is, how robust it is. Sometimes Christians give the impression that they believe it, but they don't want to investigate it. They don't want to see it investigated because perhaps there isn't such reason for confidence in the factual claims, the historic claims of Christianity. Is that true? Can it stand up to scrutiny, the kind of scrutiny that is concerned, as they used to say in the old TV drama, just the facts and only the facts. Joining us for a forensic examination of Christian truth claims on this Monday afternoon, July the 21st, J. Warner Wallace. He spent 12 years as a cold case homicide detective in Southern California. He is a speaker for Stand to Reason, and he's author of the new book, Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. Jim, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
Some Christians might be a little scared about this prospect because they think someone who is trained in the investigation of facts, putting together evidence in a case, I don't know if I want someone looking at the truth claims of Christianity. They might come up with a reason to debunk it. What's your response to that?
Well, gosh, it's actually a sad response if you think about it in terms of how much do we really believe, what it is we believe about Christianity. Is it just wishful thinking, or is this actually the most reasonable inference from the evidence? And I think that I was somebody for 35 years as an atheist who was more than willing to say, hey, if I was to spend this kind of time looking at the evidence, I'm sure I could show you how ludicrous your beliefs are as a Christian. And I didn't really set out, kind of in an effort to debunk Christianity or to prove it wrong. I just became interested in the person of Jesus for kind of some of the ancient wisdom that any classic ancient sage, whether they really lived or not, you know, these recorded proverbs of these wisdom of these ancient wise sages, I was just interested in that. And so I set out rather benignly just to kind of take a look at the wisdom of Jesus, and that did start me looking at it seriously, evidentially. The gospel accounts to see if they were really truly eyewitness accounts. And so I think that I could certainly understand someone's hesitation, and I would have been happy to challenge my Christian friends to say, hey, I can, you know, discover some things you won't be comfortable with. But I think in the end, we actually believe in something that is evidentially true and rooted in history, and therefore it's either verifiable or falsifiable. And so we shouldn't be afraid of the evidence. We should actually be willing to examine the evidence robustly.
Let's talk about defining evidence, because not everything that passes for evidence is evidence. Why is it so important to define it, and how would you define it?
Yeah, that's really important. I think I very seldom will ever say to people, I'm going to prove this to you, whatever that may be. I instead will say, I'm going to give you the evidence that I found persuasive, that led me to believe this is true. And I think the issue of whether or not this proves to you that this issue is settled is something you're going to have to examine. But the evidence, I think, large categories of evidence, we largely misunderstand them. We don't understand how evidence is used in criminal trials, how we use evidence to solve cold cases. There are two broad categories of evidence, direct evidence and indirect evidence, sometimes called circumstantial evidence. And I think what typically happens is a lot of our atheist friends, and certainly the new atheists who are writing about this, don't understand understand the two categories, and they really think unless you have direct evidence of some nature, you can't make a case. And I have never had a case that was built on direct evidence as a cold case detective. Every one of my cases over the last 12 years that I've been doing nothing but cold cases, and I did homicides for years before that, my cases are made circumstantially. I don't have living eyewitnesses who can testify directly to what actually happened. Instead, I build cases on a multitude of circumstantial evidences. This is a very powerful standard approach that we take. We convict people all the time on nothing but circumstantial evidence. And so I think we have to kind of help the culture understand the power of circumstantial evidence and how we use it every day in criminal trials. And then when we look at the case for Christianity, it becomes very powerful because it's built on just many, many layers of circumstantial evidence.
So that is a common misconception, both in the terms of evidential apologetics, but also in terms of your primary vocation, basically crime investigation. People think, wow, the term circumstantial evidence generally has a negative connotation among the laity. But in a courtroom, that's the vast majority of evidence that most judges or juries will ever hear, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we define this in California. Well, judges will typically tell jurors, hey, if somebody comes in from outside and they testify, they tell you that it's raining outside, you may accept that testimony if you find them reliable and infer that it's raining outside. On the other hand, if they come in and they shake off their raincoat and take it off and they close up their umbrella and they're dripping wet, from that piece of indirect evidence, you may infer that it's raining outside. So we come to the same conclusion, but we come to it two different ways. And I think a lot of what we do, and again, for me, I felt like my resistance as an atheist to the evidence for Christianity was really a matter of will. It was a matter of willful rebellion that God had to first do something with that rebellion. But then once that was God did that, the evidence became clear to me, evidence that I had seen for years and really had rejected and found ways to kind of reject this evidence. Now I suddenly saw it for what it was, not that I was deluded, but I was fooled by it, but instead I actually saw it clearly for the first time.
How does a detective, a crime investigator, actually work? What is the task? What are the basic skills that someone needs when they approach any kind of circumstances where they want to determine to a greater or lesser degree of certainty what the facts are?
Yeah, this is a very, very common practice for us. We have to go back and look at the chronology of what actually happened and how we determine what happened. First and foremost is on the basis of what did the original, if there were any, eyewitnesses say about this, and were those original eyewitnesses reliable? And sometimes they're reliable, or sometimes they are that they may be mistaken, and this may be an inadvertent mistake or maybe an intentional lie. We have to evaluate eyewitnesses regardless to see if what they're saying is trustworthy. And we do that with a template here in the state of California that I'm sure is the same across the nation. It's a template that judges give jurors to evaluate eyewitnesses that come to the stand. And I thought, as an atheist who was looking for the first time at the claims of the Gospels, I thought, you know, why couldn't we apply the same kind of template? There's 14 questions that jurors typically are allowed to consider as they are listening to eyewitnesses. They break down into four large categories. Could we actually assess the Gospels under those four categories? And if we were to do that, how would they measure up? And as I went through this process myself, and it took several months to do it, I became more uncomfortable daily with my own assessment of the gospel accounts. I originally saw some attributes that I thought, wow, those strike me as legitimate attributes of multiple attestations of the same event. And I thought, how am I going to, should I investigate this? And as I did, using this template, I became less and less resistant to the notion that these were just mythologies that I had always thought would, you know, developed over time. I believed these to be reliable eyewitness accounts, and that, unfortunately for me as an atheist, well, fortunately for me as a Christian, it changed the way I looked at the Gospels and the person of Jesus.
What are those four categories that are used in a courtroom that a jury is allowed to use to evaluate the veracity of a witness's testimony?
Yeah, they break into four large categories. There's a number of questions we allow witnesses to ask. But the first one is, do we think these witnesses were really present at the time? Because a lot of witnesses will tell you they were there because they like the starstruck kind of celebrity that comes with big cases. And my cases typically end up on Dateline. So these are cases where, you know, people who know the work that we do might lie to us in order to be a part of a larger case. So the question of, were they really there to see what they say they saw, that's important to us. The second one, of course, is, can they be verified and corroborated in some way? That this is something that's very important. Sometimes it's a matter of fingerprints that will corroborate some piece of the testimony or some of the kind of evidence, or maybe it's another witness that will corroborate the statements of the first witness. And the third thing is, have they been accurate or have they changed their story over time? I can tell you, working cold cases, that my suspects typically get in trouble because they do change their story over time, and it's not a real recollection. It's a lie they've created, and it's hard to remember the lie. And the fourth thing, is simply a matter of bias. Does the witness hold some form of bias or prejudice that would cause him or her to say something that's not true because they want to achieve some goal? And so I thought those four categories were worthy areas of investigation as I looked at the Gospels.
Let's just take them one at a time, if we could, beginning with the question of, were the eyewitnesses, and here we're talking about the authors or the sources of the authors of the four biblical Gospels, were they really present? Can we determine whether or not these people who claim to have seen what they saw and heard what they heard actually saw and heard it?
Yeah, this was something I always, as a skeptic, my skepticism was rooted in two large areas. The first was that these were obviously, to me, I would have argued forever, that these were going to be late accounts in history. They simply could not have been written early enough where people who were present at the time would have been able to examine them, because clearly they contained miraculous stories of supernatural miracles from my philosophically natural worldview, I deny these kinds of things could ever even be true. So clearly they must have been written so late that nobody who was alive in the first century who could have said, hey, hang on a minute, I knew Jesus and he didn't do any of those things, those folks must have all been dead. That was my presupposition. So I wanted to look and see, well, how early does the case really lead us to believe that the Gospels were written? And I think there's an excellent circumstantial case. Now, again, circumstantial simply means that we're not trusting on direct eyewitness testimony for this. Instead, we're going to build a case on many pieces of individual evidence that all point to the same conclusion. Circumstantial cases are always cumulative. So in this case, what I saw that was powerful for me was what was missing from the account of the life of the apostles after Jesus, as recorded in the book of Acts. There were several things that I thought would reasonably have been included in the book of Acts that I felt were missing, and that included, of course, the destruction of the temple. Why is this not listed when, of course, Jesus is going to predict it in Matthew 23? Why wouldn't we see this fulfilled at some point, Luke writing about it in the book of Acts? Why would the three most important characters in the book of Acts, James, Paul, and Peter, why would their deaths not be mentioned anywhere in the book of Acts? When you were mentioning the death of James, the brother of John, you've mentioned the death of Stephen. Why mention the deaths of these minor characters, relatively speaking, but leave out the deaths of the major characters that Luke is recording in the book of Acts? Why is there no mention of the siege of the temple? I mean, you can go through this and see a number of historical events that we can date, not based on all kinds of, from Josephus's writing, other people outside the scripture who will write about these events. Why are these events not recorded in the book of Acts? And if you go to the earliest one, the death of James in 61 AD, I think there's good reason to believe that the absence of these events is most reasonably points to a dating of Acts, which is prior to those events actually having occurred. And if that's the case, you're going to put Acts right around 60 to avoid to explain why the death of James in 61 is missing. But there's also, I think, internal evidence in the Gospels, the letters of Paul, for example, where he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy and mentions the Scripture and quotes from Deuteronomy and from the Gospel of Luke, where in 1 Corinthians, in describing the story, the narrative of the Lord's Supper, he includes a version of all the Gospels he could have quoted from or alluded to. He talks about it in the same way that Luke does. So there seems to be the early acceptance of Luke's Gospel, of Luke's information, that is circulating amongst Paul and all the people that Paul is writing to. I think as we look through this, it's very reasonable to date Luke's gospel ahead of the book of Acts and to place it in the 50s. And that means that I think there's a gospel that precedes Luke, And I think that's very interesting. When I was first looking at this issue as a skeptic, I was intrigued by the words of Papias in the first century, in which he says that Mark is scribing for Peter, as Peter's describing his life and ministry with Jesus. Yet Papias says that Mark is being careful about accuracy, but not so careful about order. Interesting, Luke, when writing to Theophilus in the opening of his Gospel of Luke, says that he, Theophilus, I'm presenting to you what kind of an account? He says an orderly account. And it seems interesting to me that he would refer to his account specifically as orderly when the person he's going to quote more than anyone else is Mark, the disorderly account. So I think we can place Mark in front of Luke, and that puts Mark, I think, in the late 40s, early 50s. It puts him well within the time range, not only so that he could be referencing the work, the observations of eyewitnesses, but also that he's writing during the generation of additional eyewitnesses who could have called him out if, in fact, he's telling a lie. So as I look at the case for early dating, the circumstantial case for early dating, I think there is a good case to be made for a date of the Gospels that places them within the lifetime of not only the eyewitnesses who saw Jesus, but those who maybe would have denied Jesus, who would have been able to say, hey, this didn't happen. That's a bold thing to do, is to write that early and make those kinds of claims.
Jay Warner Wallace is our guest. We're talking about forensic examination of Christian truth claims on this Monday afternoon, July the 1st. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we come back, the second category, that category of corroboration, there's actually two aspects to that. One is when you have witnesses like this who are making statements about the same event, and they don't seem to agree in every detail, does that mean that they are contradicting one another? Is that how it works in actual crime investigation? And the other aspect of it has to do with corroboration from outside those witnesses themselves with other evidence. We'll talk about both of those right after this.
Would you like to help your son or daughter achieve their maximum athletic potential? Hi, this is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio. My friend, fellow parishioner, and certified athletic trainer, Kevin Reisick, is the owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. Arch Fitness specializes in sports performance training for middle school to collegiate level athletes. For more information, call Kevin at 618-670-6952. 618-670-6952.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler? Would you like to learn more about teaching students the essentials of biblical interpretation, law and gospel, or worldviews from a Lutheran perspective? Come join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 16th through the 18th at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, visit ccle.org. That's ccle.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues, Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt,
France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, July the 1st. We're talking about forensic examination of Christian truth claims. J. Warner Wallace is our guest, author of the new book, Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. Jim, in that second category, corroboration, I wonder, because people will read the various gospel accounts, they'll notice minor differences in the same account, and they will assume that this means a contradiction. In your experience as a homicide detective, when eyewitnesses say what they saw, do they always, all these witnesses, match up lockstep?
Yeah, they don't. And this is one of those areas that I never really stumbled on. When I first read through the accounts as a non-believer, and I was just mining out the wisdom, the red letters, I really wanted to see, hey, this first pastor who interested me in Jesus, I thought, well, I'll read Jesus's letters the way I would read Socrates or Baha'u'llah or Buddha or anybody, any wise ancient sage. Not interested in God, not just wanted to see what is the most ancient wisdom about life, marriage, whatever it may be. And as I read through this and I saw the gospel accounts had variations between the accounts, places where people might look at that and say, is that a contradiction? I never stumbled there because I was already doing investigations at a level that I was dealing with lots of witnesses to the same event. And I felt like the range of differences I was seeing in the Gospels was very similar to the range of differences I would see in any set of eyewitnesses to the same event. So I think we have to realize that this is just the natural. And I try to give an example in the book just to show that in my own casework, you might sometimes interview two witnesses and think to yourself, really? These two people saw this? Were they even in the same room at the same time? You can't imagine they're describing the same event. And you have to spend time to see what is it in their perspective, either geographic perspective in the room, their personal histories, their familiarities and interests in certain things that differ from one another. Why does one get the shirt right, but one sees a gun a certain way? One doesn't even think there's a gun there to begin with. There's all kinds of reasons why there are differences between witness accounts. So that never really bothered me. What I thought was interesting, though, is whenever I'm looking to corroborate an account, I'm looking for what I call touch point corroboration. If you tell me that you leaned over the counter and pointed the gun, and someone pointed a gun at a teller, and you saw that robber do that, lean over that counter and point that gun and scream those words, and she responded by giving the money, if I go back and find his palm print on that counter in the direction it should be to justify what you said he did at the counter, that palm print would be considered corroborative evidence in front of a jury. But that palm print would tell you nothing about his words, about the fact he had a gun, what he said, how she responded. It's a touch point piece of corroboration. It only gives you a small piece from which you infer the larger corroboration. Well, this is what we have in the Gospels all the time. We have non-canonical accounts. We have pagan accounts. We have Jewish accounts of Jesus that just give us a piece, a small piece from which we can infer the corroboration for the larger account. We would never expect to get every detail corroborated. I've never seen that happen. Corroborative evidence gives you a piece from which you infer the larger. And that's what I see all the time with both archaeology and some internal evidence that's related to use of proper names. There's lots of reasons to see, lots of ways to look at the evidence and identify what I call touch point corroboration.
In your investigation, coming at it as a detective, did you find anything in the eyewitness accounts, that is these four New Testament Gospels, that led you to believe that the testimony here is in some way false, that there's something in there that invalidates what's being said about the broader circumstances?
Yeah, I think for me, the biggest, I always assumed, I mean, I just rejected on its face the supernatural elements of the accounts. So as a non-believer, I was looking at it and saying, well, how do these get in here? Either they're written late, and if they're not written late, and I quickly moved away from that idea once I started doing the work and the research. Then the question was, well, they must have been changed then. I mean, whatever account was written in the first century, it cannot be the same account we have today, because clearly it could not have inserted these supernatural elements. This has got to be a late modification of the account, some legend that grew over time. And so I do think that one way we can assess this is to simply look at the chain of custody. In any crime scene, we see a piece of evidence. We track it over time. Did this officer at the scene document it? Did he photograph it? Did he give it to another officer, sign it over to property? Property documents it again, photographs it again. When he gives it to the crime lab, they document it, they photograph it again. Through time, from the event of the crime to the actual trial, this piece of evidence will be handled a number of times, but hopefully it'll be documented in such a way that we can see if it's been tampered with. And the same thing, I think, can be done with the New Testament gospel writers. We know that John writes a gospel, some gospel, but what did it look like? How do we know it didn't change over time? Well, we can simply go to the next officer in the chain of custody, which are his students. John had students that wrote about the gospel that John taught them. That's Ignatius and Polycarp. Like, we can simply look at those two authors and say, well, how did they describe Jesus as they understood him from John? And we can take a snapshot of Jesus once again, and then we can go to their student, Irenaeus, and how did Irenaeus see Jesus? And Irenaeus' student, Hippolytus, how did Hippolytus? And we can keep on doing this through time, and we'll see that I was very amazed, really, at the consistency of the picture of Jesus over time. This person who I would have rejected, the miracle worker who claimed to be God and rose from the dead, unfortunately, that is the clearest picture of Jesus that's repeated through the centuries from the very first eyewitnesses to their students, to their students, to theirs. It's not a late legend that grew over time. That's the consistent story of the eyewitnesses.
Then, in that last category, has to do with whether or not a witness has some sort of bias, either recognized or unrecognized, that would motivate them to make something up or to lie. What did you find there?
Well, first of all, the idea of conspiracies, I've really always been somebody who resisted conspiracy theories because I've worked so many conspiracies and I know how hard they are to pull off. There are several characteristics of conspiracies that have to be in place, and I won't go into all the details there, but I can tell you those aspects of conspiracies are missing with the apostles. The things you need to have in place, I did a whole chapter on just that one issue, but for me, the issue of bias typically comes down to motive. What is motivating the witness to lie? And any misdoing, if it's a murder or just lying on the stand, all misbehaviors are only motivated by the same three motives or some subset of those three motives. Whenever I'm looking at a homicide scene, I'm simply asking myself, who in the victim's life is motivated in one of these three areas? And they are always financial greed, sexual or relational lust, and the pursuit of power. Those three things are what are behind every case I've ever worked. So I'm looking at a witness and saying to myself, okay, why is this person lying? Is it what's their gain financially, or what's their gain from relationship or sex, or what's their gain in terms of power or prestige or influence, whatever it may be? And so I'm looking for the same kinds of things when it comes to the apostles. If they're lying about this, not just one person, but all of them, and not just lying in the good times, they're lying all the way to their deaths, to their martyrdoms, what is motivating them? Did they get rich out of this? Did they, find themselves in the lots of wives and girlfriends? Did they find themselves, powerful enough to even control their own destiny? Or is this the kind of thing that when you say, hey, look over here, you're actually drawing fire rather than gaining power? And so I think that for me, as I looked at the lives of the apostles and what happened to them as a result of their taking a stand on this claim that they saw what they said they saw, I don't see the motive. I think it's missing. And I try to examine that thoroughly, both in terms of financial, sexual, and power motives, to see what is there that could have pushed these 12 to make these claims.
In the end, do you find then with the eyewitnesses that they lack those motives, that in fact, not only do they lack those motives, they appear to be men bent upon holding to this truth, this alleged lie, even if it does mean their own lives?
Yeah, and I think that if I tell people all the time, if you and I, as 21st century Christians, said we would be willing to die for this claim, that has zero evidential power, in my view. But if the original eyewitness who was there and who knew better, if it is a lie, that person knew it was a lie, if that person is willing to die for the claim, that has great evidential value. So I think as we look at the original eyewitnesses, that's where the push, kind of the rubber meets the road. We have to look and say, most of us would be willing to say, hey, we believe this, and we believe it so sincerely that we'd be willing to die for it. But for those people who would know if it was a lie to be willing to die for, that's a very different thing altogether. And I became so convinced of the reliability of these accounts after doing this kind of work. But I can remember sitting with my wife and saying, you know, Susie, I am in. I think these are reliable. I trust them. I trust what they say about Jesus. But I still, Todd, I didn't know what the gospel was. I believed the gospel accounts, but I said to my wife, I just don't understand what the cross is all about. I don't understand why it had to happen. And so I was actually committed to the accounts as reliable eyewitness accounts before I even understood what it is they were really telling me about my own condition, my own need for a Savior. And so that's from, I came at it that way. I came at it, first of all, are these reliable accounts? And then, of course, that was belief. That is true, right? But I believed in it and trusted in it once I realized my own need. And that's a whole other, I mean, to me, I had to break down my staunch philosophical naturalism, my resistance to the gospel accounts. And once that occurred, I felt myself just at every wall that I had constructed started to topple down.
J. Warner Wallace is our guest. We're talking with him about a forensics examination of Christian truth claims on this Monday afternoon, July the 1st. He spent 12 years as a cold case homicide detective in Southern California, a speaker for Stand to Reason, and author of the new book, Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. When we come back, we're going to talk about some being wary of the presuppositions that we bring into any investigation of these kind of truth claims. We'll be right back.
Noted author and Christian apologist Craig Hawkins on why you should support Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure to recommend to you Issues Etc. It's one of the few programs discussing crucial concerns for Christians. It's done in a dynamic format, again, discussing crucial issues, and in an insightful manner. The program is very much needed. In my opinion, it's one of the most important broadcasts on the air, and it's one of my favorites. So if you want to grow in your faith, know what you believe and why, then this program is for you. I want to encourage you to listen, and I want to encourage you to support the broadcast, both prayerfully and financially.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234, or you can make a credit card donation at our website, issuesetc.org, Defending the Faith, Teaching the Truth, Issues Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Issues, etc. What does this mean? We want to hear from you. Why do you listen? How has it helped you? What are your favorite topics? Who are your favorite guests? And what makes Issues Etc. unique? Please leave your thoughts about this worldwide outreach on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Issues Etc. What does this mean? 618-223-8382.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a forensic examination of Christian truth claims. J. Warner Wallace, author of the book Cold Case Christianity, is our guest. In hour two of the program, Pastor Tom Baker will join us. We'll talk about the case of King Josiah and the missing scroll of the covenant. And then Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch will join us. We'll talk about two stories, the beheading of a Catholic priest by Syrian rebels and violence erupting in Egypt that seemed to be continuing, leading perhaps to martial law in that country. Jim, I want to talk about some of the nuts and bolts of this thing. Let's say, for instance, I'm a skeptic and I say, okay, I would like to investigate this on the basis of the facts. I'm all about the facts. You say that we should be extremely cautious about especially the presuppositions that we may or may not realize we have, yet we carry into this process.
Yeah, I mean, that's I just use an illustration because it actually happened to me in an early homicide that I worked. As we walked into the room, we saw what we believed to be a domestic violence type of homicide. These are categories of homicides. You work, you know, certain kinds. Some are drive-bys. Some are different categories. And when you see this type of category, sometimes you run to a conclusion about what kind of suspect you're looking for. And we did just that. We walked in and we said, oh, this is going to be a spousal or a boyfriend kind of a homicide. Let's find out who she's dating, who she's married to. This is who we should be looking for. And we wasted probably a good week looking for the wrong kind, the wrong category of suspect. It ended up being a complete stranger to her who happened to live a couple, you know, next door, and the most unlikely of all suspects. And instead of kind of following the evidence, we made some broad sweeping assumptions, and then we started to see the evidence in the room as we were coloring it, basically, from our assumptions. You know, if we saw that there was some clothing missing in the closet, we thought, well, the husband must have taken that clothing. We saw a picture hanging on her nightstand with her and another man, and we thought that must be her husband or her boyfriend. None of these things were true. And we just happened to start to see the evidence because we had a desire to find the kind of suspect that we were looking for in advance. So you can't walk into crime scenes, the homicide scenes, with a suspect in mind. You have to walk in completely neutral and let the evidence take you where it may. And here was my problem as an atheist, is that I was somebody who walked in with the conclusion already drawn. I rejected the supernatural. And as a philosophical naturalist, I began the investigation into something supernatural, the existence of God, with the foundational claim that nothing supernatural could exist. So naturally, every time anything was presented to me, I found a way to deny it, because my presuppositions guide my investigation. So I think we have to be careful in both sides. I mean, I'm not the kind of person as a Christian now who runs to supernatural explanations either. I simply want the evidence to take me where it leads, and then I will try to neutrally evaluate that evidence as best I can. And that's a real challenge, I think, for a lot of non-believers who reject the supernatural a priori.
You have used the term infer or inference several times in the course of our conversation. Explain abductive reasoning to us.
Yeah, this is the process that we use all the time in every criminal trial, and I suspect most people use this all the time, just when talking to their friends or talking to their spouses or their kids when they're coming home late from an event. You know, we're constantly looking at the evidence in the room, making a mental list of everything we see, and then making another mental list of all the possible explanations for what it is we see, and then we begin to compare those two lists. You know, what do I see evidentially? What are the ways of explaining this? Which, then, of these possible explanations is the most reasonable inference given my examination of the evidence? So if I walk into a death scene, I'm simply looking at the evidence in the room, and I know there's only four possible explanations for death, you know, natural, accidental, suicide, or homicide. And as I'm looking at the evidence in the room, I'm starting to cross off the list, you know, which of these is no longer reasonable given the evidence in the room. And I think that's what we do when we examine any set of evidences to come to the most reasonable. Jurors certainly do this, and it's called abductive reasoning, this idea, this process of inferring to the most reasonable explanation. And that's the kind of thing that I think is reasonable for us. That's an approach we can take, for example, in examining all kinds of issues related to the existence of God. Do the evidences in the universe, are they most reasonably explained through natural processes or through divine interaction? When we're looking at the evidences for the resurrection, are the basic minimal facts that we think we can all agree on related to the resurrection, are they best explained by some natural explanation or by the claims of Christianity? This is the process I think we can use for almost any examination of truth claims.
You also say that we ought to pay very careful attention to the language, to particular words, to chosen language. And why is this so important, especially when we're examining written accounts from alleged eyewitnesses in the New Testament accounts?
Yeah, that's something that I kind of got fascinated in years ago when I was a very new investigator, and we were looking at, we take interview classes, and we do a lot I did a lot of jail interviews for the first 4 or 5 years I worked as an investigator. So you're always listening to the words of people in custody, the words of suspects, and then eventually I started to have them write these things down for me so I could do what we call a forensic statement analysis, where we look at the one-page document in which the suspect is going to tell us everything he did on the day of the murder, from the time he got up in the morning to the time he went to bed. And then we're going to analyze this for its use of pronouns, its use of tense, of certain kinds of verbs and adjectives, his compression of time, expansion of time. We're looking at certain characteristics in the use of his language. And then we've got enough information about him. We've talked to him long enough to know how he uses language regularly, and we can actually assess what is the kind of the hidden content that is there, and what does it really mean for the truth value of the statement. And I did the same kind of thing as a skeptic, looking at the Gospel of Mark. You know, we talked about Papias says that Peter is the source for that information. Is that true? Do I have any good reason to believe that's true? Is there any internal information based on language in the Gospel of Mark that would lead me to believe that Peter does have a special influence in this Gospel that is missing in the other Gospels? That was a process I did early on as a skeptic, because I was just grasping for any possible way to and at some point I was becoming less and less comfortable with my own conclusions related to the reliability of the Gospels, and this was one of those last things I needed to do. And I remember doing it with the Gospel of Mark for about a month. I just completely inked in my Bible for that entire month, making all kinds of notations. And by the time I was done, I was convinced that Peter's fingerprints are in the Gospel of Mark in a way that I think just led more reliability to that account.
Finally, then, with only about a minute or so here, kind of returning that person we were talking about at the beginning, maybe a slight variation on that, the person who says, look, it doesn't really matter whether all these things really happened. What really matters is that I believe that they happened. How would you respond to that with about a minute here?
Yeah, real quickly, when I first came to faith, my family was divided between atheists and Mormons. And one of the things that I rejected was this idea that I'm not going to settle for a useful delusion. The idea that this might work for me is not going to be my motivation. I'm a Christian today, Todd, not because it works for me. That's the last reason. There are many days when it doesn't even seem to work for me. There's many days where I wish I could take a shortcut like I used to when I was a non-believer, or do the things that were expedient rather than right. But Christianity, I'm a Christian today because it is true. And I think living in the truth is a much more desirable way to live. As an atheist, I would have said that. I want to live in the truth, not in some useful delusion. And that's where I think I am today. I'm living in the truth of this, not because I want it to be true, but because it's true even when I don't want it to be true.
J. Warner Wallace spent 12 years as a cold case homicide detective in Southern California. He's a speaker for Stand to Reason, author of the new book Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. You'll find a link to this book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we're going to talk with Pastor Tom Baker. We'll be in 2 Kings chapter 22. Very interesting story. Things have gotten as bad as one can imagine they could be. The temple has been destroyed, and in the midst of this destruction of the temple or its ruins of the temple, they can't even find the Bible. But they do. They find the Bible, and young King Josiah, after following a number of very, very bad kings, in finding this covenant, rediscovers the God of that covenant. Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.